Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I am Linda Gray Sexton, author of two memoirs, Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother, Ann Sexton, and Bespotted, My Family's Love Affair with 38 Dalmatians. I'm going to be your moderator for the program. Mm-hmm. Tonight's program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's now my pleasure, privilege, honor, and happy-making evening to introduce our distinguished speaker, Erica Jong, author of the legendary novel, Fear of Flying, and her brand new novel, Fear of Dying. She really needs no introduction. Prolific and always provocative in grappling with her subject matter, she is the author of 25 books, able to move effortlessly between poetry, fiction, and memoir, and has already made gigantic strides in covering ground most authors only think about covering in a lifetime. She has been compared in glowing terms to literary lions like Philip Roth, Henry Miller, John Updike, and also dominates the list of trailblazing women authors who speak for women in our society today. While she has won a host of literary prizes, to me, the true spirit of Erica's writing is in her courage. She unmasks her own demons and illuminates life for us all. Fear of Flying has sold over 27 million copies and been translated into 40 languages, becoming something of a Bible to women of all ages and all generations. But this was only Erica's first step, and she never said, "Mother, may I?" In one book after another over the ensuing four decades, she has tackled the tough stuff by looking deeply into herself. Love, sex, motherhood, marriage, fantasy, reality, infidelity, friendship, work. Have I forgotten anything? Yes. Peace and power for both sexes.
Wow.
In short,
are
she
you
is
talking about me?
Yeah. I'm talking about you, girl. In short, she has challenged and will continue to challenge the way we think about life in its entirety. I read Fear of Dying at the same time I reread Fear of Flying, and I found both equally powerful. You are in for a treat when you get to this one. The current novel is set in the 21st century as Vanessa Wunderman, who is 60 and the best friend of Isadora Wing of Fear of Flying fame, comes to grapple with many of the same questions from a new perspective and a new voice that her BFF grappled with in the 20th. I couldn't put either book aside and found myself reading late into the night. 42 years since her first novel, Erica's adventurous journey has whisked us across the bridge into a new century. I hope she will tell us tonight where we are now. Would you welcome Erica Jong? You You got a lot of fans here.
This is, you know, my favorite city in the world. What can we say? I mean, when I come to the Bay Area, I always think I'm going to move here. Earthquake or no earthquake. You got to go one day, so you might as well go dramatically. Right? So I have to say that Linda and I have been friends for a long time. We have a lot in common. She is a wonderful writer, a memoirist, a novelist, and she took on the incredible burden of her mother's poetry, Anne Sexton's poetry. And actually, after we talk tonight, I'm going to ask her how hard it was, because I'm redoing my will, and my daughter keeps saying, nobody but me will be your literary executor. And I say things like, but, you know, you should talk to Linda, because it's a lot of work. And it might interfere with your writing. And as your mother, I don't want that to happen. The other thing is, that's very weird, Molly never reads my books. And she doesn't want to be influenced. And you might think this is strange, but John Updike once told me that his children never read his books, because they wanted to write. So often when I give a lecture or an interview, people would say, sort of threateningly, what does your daughter think? And my daughter tells the interviewer, I never read my mother's books. It's not good for my mental health. So I said, look, if I make you the literary executrix, and she said, it can't be anybody else, Mom, or Mamo, which is what she calls me. I said, you have to realize it's a lot of work. And you're going to have to handle with those agents who are not on the author's side. They're on their own side. And you're going to have to handle with all these terrible people. I don't have to tell you.
You don't have to tell me.
And I said, you've got to be sure that's what you want to do. Call Linda.
She should call me.
And tell, you know, anyway, just as a side note, I knew your mother and loved her poetry. And she was so kind to me when I was a young poet. And she once wrote a letter to me. She'd sent me some new poems. And this, I think, is important. And I said, I dared to say, because I was the young poet and she was, you know, the master. I said, Anne, you know, I love these poems, but don't you think they're a bit excessive? And she said, I am an excessive person, and I apologize for nothing. That is who I am, and if I suppress my nature, my writing won't be as good as it is. And there was a passion in her and in her writing. And she taught me that you cannot suppress that passion. And I always tell my writing students, if you want to be a writer, never show your family, any member of your family, a work in progress. You will never finish the book. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, and people ask me about writing memoir and how my family feels about what I've written. I always say, you know, I really don't ask.
Yeah.
I think it's unfair to me, and it's really unfair to them, because what am I going to say to them? I fully intend to write it anyway. And I try
right.
I try really hard to be as objective as possible, sometimes to give them a voice. My last memoir, Half in Love, I actually interviewed my sister and my two kids to find out how they felt about a time I went through where I was suicidal and falling apart. And I wanted to give them a voice, and I actually quote them in the memoir, which is a very unusual thing to do. Ordinarily,
yeah.
We don't. But I find that for the most part, you need to leave your family, you know, you need to just put up a little bit of a screen. You understand how they feel, but if you are continually asking them, they're going to get upset. And what are you going to do? You're going to write it anyway.
And it becomes a form of self-censorship.
Yeah.
And the last thing that a woman writer needs after centuries of self-censorship is censorship from the daughters and sons.
Yeah.
Because they don't give a shit about that. They care about their own lives, as they should. Because if you've raised them well, you've raised them to be their own people.
Right.
And they don't want to be your handmaiden. Molly deals with it by not reading me. And interviewers call her and say, what did you think of your mother's book? It's all about you, which it isn't. It's just a provocative journalist question to get a rise out of her, mm-hmm. right? Journalists are not your friends. And they will say almost anything to get a good controversial interview, as you know.
Yes, indeed.
And so I always tell writing students, if you want to never finish the book, show it to your family. And that's a very important thing.
It is.
Really.
And I think one of the things my mother said, and I believe she also said it to you, which she said to me over and over and over again, was, tell it true.
Yes.
And uh-huh. that really rang so, it rang inside me so sharply. I began to understand that you couldn't compromise the story you have to tell to please anybody else. You had to tell what you saw as the truth.
Absolutely.
It's always your own version. I mean, a memoir is your own version.
Right.
You're not writing a I would never write a biography of my mother. I wouldn't even attempt to do such a thing. But I could write a memoir about my own life with my mother.
And your own feelings.
And my feelings, my emotions, what it was like to grow up with her, how to cope with mental illness, you know, many things that I felt comfortable talking to the public about where I might not feel comfortable talking to my sister about it.
Right, because you're definitely going to have different views. I had an experience a few years ago. Columbia acquired my literary archive, and they made a big conference at Columbia University. And it was to celebrate my work. I went to graduate school at Columbia. I went to Barnard undergraduate. And they essentially were anointing Fear of Flying as a classic. It's now been published as a Penguin classic. And everything about that was a sort of coming of age for me. And it was a great celebratory thing. In the entr'acte between the first part and the second part, in marches my older sister. I'm the middle sister of three, which makes me the clown, the conciliator, the person who brings everything together, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So Susanna comes in during the entr'acte and gets up and says, I love my sister very much, and I'm so proud of her, even though she's entirely ruined my life.
I bet it didn't feel funny.
It didn't feel funny. And you can look this up in The New Yorker, because the PR person who works with me on various books, we had worked for about 6 months to get The New Yorker to cover this conference, okay?
God.
And they, you know, when I first came out as a writer, the critics were not kind. Let's see. Martin Amis was not happy. The guy who wrote all those memoirs, what is his name? His name is gone. Paul Theroux said, Isadora Wing is nothing but a mammoth pudenda. Roomy as the Carlsbad Caverns, leading amorous spelunkers into her enormous depths. Now, Paul Theroux didn't know anything about my pudenda or dumb, and he had never glimpsed it, let alone sniffed it, right? But he was very happy to review Fear of Flying for the New Statesman or some one of these little uptight British things. And he, it was such a hurtful review. A mammoth pudenda? My God. you know, you're just a big pussy. You're a cunt. You're a vajayjay, a vagina, which in 1973 was not a good thing to be. 74. Now you can say vagina. I once did the vagina monologues in New York. We can, thanks to Eve Ensler, we can actually say it and make plays about it. But in those days, you couldn't. 74 in the UK, they were very uptight. And I had gone through all that stuff when the book came out. Some people said it was a great book. Some people said, if the Erica Jongs of this world have their way, women everywhere will be jumping from bed to bed. That was, I think, Time magazine, which declares feminism dead every 20 years, you may have noticed. They always have the cover story, is feminism dead? And of course, they always get a woman writer to say that it is. I get it, you know. So my sister gets up and basically says that I've ruined her life, okay. So the journalist from the New Yorker, who's lovely, actually, and a friend of my daughter's, comes to me during the intermission when everybody's taking tea and says, what a shock, what has happened here? And I said, well, my dear, every family has insane members. And my older sister is no exception. But inside I was deeply shaken, you can imagine, and I had to put on a brave face. So after experiences like that with my family, that's why I tell you never to show your work to
what
your family.
What did you say to her following?
Following?
Yeah.
She took her two girlfriends by the arm and scuttled out of there. She did not wait.
She didn't even face you.
No, she didn't face me. And the piece in the New Yorker, you can look it up on the bloody internet, was not about how I was now a classic, but it was all about how she had denounced me because it made good copy. Any journalist wants eyeballs, whether online or on paper or whatever, because controversy sells, and every journalist is terrified that journalism is ending, which in some ways it is. We have a Murdoch-ized press now, and it's appealing to the lowest common denominator. And people who stab each other and shoot each other are going to get far more coverage than a mere writer. It's just the way things are now. And they're going to go out and tweet horrible things about you. If everybody in the room loves you and there's one person grouchy, that's the person who's going to get quoted. I mean, it's just the way things are. So my sister took off with her two friends on either side, and the piece came out, and it was really all about how I ruined my sister's life, but and me saying every family has insane members. My family has so many insane members. I mean, I had a fiercely critical mother, which is why I gave up painting and went to writing. Blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to go into that. But I had so many neurotic people in my family and bipolar people, and I won't even go into it at this point. But the piece became all about her, my sister, and not about me, which I suppose was the point. Right.
And how is Molly going to deal with all of this as your literary executor? Because you inherit all these problems and all these controversies.
Right.
And then you have to deal with them all. And it's not easy. You're standing up for your mother and her reputation. And I was the sort of person, I was different than Molly. I did read all her things because in the long run, guess what? You have to read it all in order to make decisions about it.
Yes.
So she's going to find...
But she, hopefully, my mother lived to be 101. Even though, you know, my mother lived to be 101, my maternal grandfather lived to be 98 and painted the whole time. My father lived to be 93. So maybe there's time for Molly to read my books before I cork off.
Indeed.
Possibly. You know, we hope. I understand completely why writing her fourth novel right now, she doesn't want to read my novels, and I honor that. But if I live long enough, she'll read them eventually,
yes.
I know.
And as she gets older and more established in her own voice, it won't be as threatening
to
her.
She won't care.
No.
And that's what I'm figuring. Right.
It will change. Right. It will change.
Right.
And I'm sure that she'll do a great job. And frankly, I don't think anybody can do the same job that a daughter who's attached, a family member, but I'll probably a son can do a great job too, but the mother-daughter thing is very strong.
Very strong.
And if you're both writers, it's even stronger. So I think, you know, it's a very complicated job because you have to handle not only the publication of posthumous material, because
but
you're
your
so
own
prolific,
feelings.
But your own feelings
right.
and the controversies. You talk about your controversies, they'll become her controversies.
Right.
I certainly faced a lot of controversies with the release of my mother's psychiatric tapes, and we had that whole brouhaha in the New York Times, to which I had to respond and deal with because I was the one who had released them as
and
the literary executor.
And you had to deal in a measured, calm way
yes,
when you
exactly.
couldn't possibly feel measured and calm.
No.
So it's a challenge, a
it
huge
is a challenge.
Challenge.
It's a challenge.
Anyway, we don't have to go on with this because hopefully I'm not dying tomorrow. But it is a big deal, and I hope you and Molly will talk about it.
I would love to talk to Molly.
And
I'd
anyway,
be happy to. I'd
because
happy
she has
to.
Said to me, I know I don't read your work, but if you appoint anybody else,
I'm going to kill you before
right.
your time.
Anyway, and then she said something else very funny. She said, I suppose that when you're dead, I'll forgive you. And one of the things that I deal with in this book is how our parents become saintly when they're gone. It's very interesting. All the things that annoy us about them, and they are so annoying, really. And my mother was terribly competitive with me. But as they recede into the past, it's amazing how angelic they become. I never will understand this. And you think about them all the time. My mother is in my ear every day of my life. If I go to Barney's in LA, where I have been for a few days, and I try on some phenomenal designer dress. If, God forbid, the salesperson says, that's a very popular dress. We've already sold 1,000. I hear my mother saying, that's why I don't want it. I don't want to wear a dress that everyone has. I don't want to be ordinary. And neither does my daughter. And that she would demolish the salesperson. Amazing. She never wanted to be ordinary, and she never wanted us to be ordinary. And I can hear her voice saying, get out of there, don't buy that dress. Everybody is going to have that dress.
And you just touched on my favorite scene in the book.
In Fear of Flying.
In Fear of Dying.
Which one is that? I can barely remember.
Okay. Can I tell you
yes.
what it is? Okay. There's this fabulous scene where Vanessa and her husband, Asher, go to India, and they decide they're going to go on something of a spiritual quest
right.
and go down deep into a very dark cave, very womb-like, I
yes.
thought, very womb-like cave. And the guide doesn't want to take them there and says, no, you cannot go unless you have forgiven everyone in your life. Well, Vanessa is a lively, stubborn person. She's lost her parents. She's on a quest for forgiveness, to forgive the shortcomings, and she decides she's going to go. So they go down, and for me, this whole scene is so full of metaphor and contrast and mm-hmm. parallel, where Isadora finds her answers by flying, Vanessa's going to find her answers by burrowing, she's going into the earth where her parents have just been buried, they're in the earth. She's now going down. And I even thought of Dante and Virgil descending through the circles of hell. Vanessa and Asher are descending, trying to come to terms, trying to find resolution. They get lost down there. They can't find
the
their way out.
Come.
And the guide
the
won't
guide
come
thinks
because
it's too
the guide
spooky.
Is scared. And Vanessa hears her mother's voice, and her mother says, "Don't be afraid. Fear is a waste of life," which I thought was a fabulous line, and what a thing to take away from this book. You know, it's fear of dying. We're dealing with dying here. It's not, we're not just talking about sex anymore. Mortality is mixed in. There's still sex, lots of it, but mortality is really a main theme here. And for to hear her mother's voice, the way you hear your mother's voice
in my
Barney's
all the time.
In your head, and Vanessa's hearing it in her head, and she does find her way out. Tell us how she finds her way
out.
Well,
I can't spoil the ending.
Okay, don't spoil the
but
ending.
But there is a part of the ending of this book. Shortly after my father died, we made our first trip to India, and we went mostly to Rajasthan. And I was really in deep grief because my dad absolutely adored me and my grandfather adored me. And one of the reasons I love men is I had all these men in my life who adored me, which is always very nice. And it's also why my sisters hated me, okay? But we went to the caves of Elephanta. Has anyone been there? Yeah.
Oh,
you take
lots
a little,
of people.
The caves in my book are invented and imaginary, but the inspiration were the caves of Elephanta. So you take a little boat, a dinky little boat, an hour out of Mumbai. You leave via the great gate that honors Queen Victoria. And when you get in this dinky little boat that seems leaky and unsafe, you see monks in saffron robes and tourists and all kinds of people. When you get to the island of Elephanta, there are monkeys and people wanting to carry you on a palanquin. It's quite extraordinary. And monkeys eating bananas in the trees, amazing. And then you come to this huge cave. And there in that cave, you see the life of Shiva or Vishnu. And you see Shiva as a little boy playing at his mother's knee. You see Shiva as a bridegroom with Parvati at his side. Then you see Shiva as a father of children. Then you see Shiva as growing older, and Parvati growing older. And in the very last statue, and these are monumental statues, carved in a cave by monks who may have even been blind. I'm not even sure if that's accurate, but I was told that. And in the last monumental statue, you see Shiva or Vishnu as a sadhu with a begging bowl. So you see boyhood to old age. And I walked from one statue to another in this gloom. And I thought my father was a little boy playing stickball in Brownsville, Brooklyn. My father was a bridegroom. My father became the father of children, me and my sisters. My father, you know, he fought like cats and dogs with my mother, but he adored her, and she adored him. And they screamed at each other like banshees, but they had so much fun, and they were really hot for each other. And then in the very end, I see him as the sadhu with the begging bowl, the wise, old, charitable man. And I thought, yes, he did all those things. And at the end of his life, he cared a lot about tzedakah, charity, and he and I established a fund at Barnard College called the Erica Manjong Writing Fund, and I continue that by supporting a bunch of young women scholars at Barnard. And my father helped me found this this foundation at my alma mater. And so he cared a lot about charity at the end of his life, and he had made a lot of money as a businessman, although he had started as a musician and a songwriter. And he really believed in giving back, in generativity. And I looked and looked at this figure of the sadhu with the begging bowl, who's given away all his worldly goods and is giving back. And I stood there and stood there, and I thought, he did all the things a man is supposed to do. He was a little boy. He was a young man. He was a bridegroom. He had a wife. He bore children. They bore children together. He raised his daughters. He was insistent that we all get degrees, and we did, and graduate degrees, and we did. And then at the end, he became a philanthropist. And I walked back and forth and back and forth, and I thought, he has done everything a man is supposed to do in life. He has completed the cycle. I can let go. And although the caves in this book are very different, and the story is very different, and the ending we won't give away,
no.
However, it inspired these imaginary caves in India, and Vanessa, my heroine's ability to let her father go. And so it was inspired by real life, but as I always tell my writing students, get the reader to turn the page. There's nothing more boring. Voltaire says that the secret of being a bore is to tell everything. And students come to me, and I teach at Rancho La Puerta in Mexico now, and they say, the course is called How to Write the Story of Your Life. And the first thing we do is outline. We start with a moment of an epiphany in your life, either an illness, the birth of a child, the loss of a loved one, whatever, something that changed you inside. And then we outline what proceeded from that change. And I always say, you can't tell everything. You can't go back to your great, 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 great grandparents. You can do that in flashbacks. But it would be incredibly boring to start that way,
really,
which a lot of people do.
Really boring.
And get the reader to turn the page. Find what's funny. Find what's touching. Don't tell everything, as Voltaire said. Don't be a bore. And I realized that letting go of my father was contingent upon my recognizing that he had been through all the cycles of life. And I did let go of him. And he's in my ear all the time. Yes.
Like your mother.
Like my mother. She's in one ear, he's in the other. And my grandfather's up here, my third eye. They're all there, and I can hear their voices, and I dream about them constantly. But essentially, you have to let them go. You have to love them and let them go. And the toughest thing in human life for me, it's like when your baby is born, you always think to yourself, how will I ever relate to this baby even as your milk is coming down? How will I love this creature, this fragile creature, that I'm responsible for? And then you bond with the child. You think you never will. And then you worry about them. And then every time they go out to play, you think, oh my God, will they die? And every time they have a fever or diarrhea, you're scared to death. And then the hardest thing in parenthood is letting them go. So we have to bond. We have to care. We have to worry. And then we have to open our hand and say, Geh gesund. And that is the same thing with death. Exactly. It's like a replica. And when you can let go, then wisdom comes. I don't know why. I think for thousands of years, human beings have been doing this in different ways, in different traditions. But it is the cycle of life. And it's fascinating. It also enabled me not to be afraid of being older, because I would not trade my vision of the world now for anything. It's like I see the circles getting completed. Totally, the circles are getting completed. And Vanessa begins this book in utter and absolute terror of aging. She gets a facelift. She's on every kind of diet you can imagine. She's doing yoga. She's lifting weights. You name it. And by the end of the book, she has totally accepted the joy of being older. And that happened to me.
There you are.
Now, literally, the book is not me. My heroine is an actress. The only gig I ever did was doing the Vagina Monologues in New York at the West Side Arts. I had that experience. But being an actor is very different from being a writer, enormously different. And it was interesting to me to write about a different kind of artist. I had such fun with that. And I had had some experiences with that, like doing the Vagina Monologues in New York. And my friends who were directors and actors would come and see me, and they would say, "It was pretty good. Don't quit your day job."
There you go. I want to take you back for a minute. Well, first of all, I have to read, if I can find it, this little reminder. And then I want to ask you a question.
What reminder? What reminder?
It's not a reminder for you. It's a reminder for our broadcasting audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest tonight is Erica Jong. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. Here's my question.
Okay.
I want to go back because you cover so much all at once. It's so beautiful. I love the way you lead from one thing into another. But I was so intrigued by your talking about the foundation and your father's influence and tzedakah, which means taking care of the world and charity. It's a wonderful Jewish word. My mother was the one who introduced me to Fear of Flying, which quickly replaced Madame Bovary as my favorite book.
And it's a pretty good book.
It's a pretty good book, but I loved Isadora. Near that time, my mother wrote you a letter in which she said, "I keep thinking that there isn't one poem being written by any one of us, or a book, or anything like that. The whole life of us writers is one long poem, a community effort. It's all the same poem. It doesn't belong to any one writer. You have a gift, and with it comes responsibility." And I just thought, wow, that says so much to me, and it fits so well with what you're talking about with regard to the foundation. It's giving back. Now, when I first met you at a reading for Fear of 50, I believe that's where it was, you said to me, "Your mother was so generous to me."
She was. She was amazing.
But then you turned it around, and you were generous to me, and you have given me so much over the years. It really matters. I like to think of you as my mentor. And I wonder, here's my question.
Okay.
My question is, how important do you think a mentor is in the life of a young woman writer? Is it more important for a woman than as a man? And secondly, who are your mentors?
Well, that's absolutely a great question, because when I was a young writer with in my 20s and 30s, with long blonde hair and a mini skirt and those little white Courage boots, if anybody remembers them. And I never want to wear the 70s revival clothes. I did it, okay? Molly and I go to a store to shop, and we do the retail therapy thing that mothers and daughters do. And she says, "Mommy, the 70s revival." And I say, "Leave me alone. I did it in the 70s. You do the 70s revival, not me." Okay, so it's crazy. But what I really, really want in the book, Vanessa wants to go back in time. She wants to be young, and she wants to know what she knows at 60. And I nearly wrote the book as a trip back in time, and then I didn't, you know? When I was a young writer, the older women writers looked daggers at me. I met Elizabeth Hardwick. She looked at me as if she wanted to sink me into the floor. She was like, you know, she was married to Robert Lowell, and he left her for Carolyn Blackwood, and and he was quite crazy, Lowell. He was
really crazy.
Really bipolar, yeah. And he wrote all those mental illness poems that people consider the first, really the first confessional poems. And Anne and Sylvia Plath were his students.
Studied with him, yes.
Studied with him at Harvard, I think?
Yes, in a class at Harvard, and yes, in a class at Harvard.
Right.
That's where.
But those older women writers looked at me as if they would kill, because I was cute. I had blonde hair down to my pupik, and long, you know, and I was cute, and they didn't want to know about me. But John Updike and Henry Miller nurtured me.
Interesting. So not women writers, but men writers.
In my time, okay. Then I had a wonderful woman named Grace Griffin, who was in publishing. She ran the publishing stuff at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she knew everybody in publishing. And one day, I brought her my poems. And she looked down at this manuscript, and she said, "I'm always so scared when I read a manuscript of poems. What if they're terrible?" And I went away, and I came back maybe a week later, and she said, "I've read your poems. You are going to be the most famous woman poet of your generation." And I thought the woman was crazy, insane. And she slipped this book of poems to a friend of hers who was the managing editor of Holt, who slipped it to the editor-in-chief of Holt, in those days a man, Aaron Asher, who published it, 1971, okay? Then I published another book of poems called Half Lives, and then Aaron said, "Oh, surely you must have a novel. Now, today, there isn't a publisher on the planet who would publish two books of poetry and say, 'Surely you must have a novel.'" I mean, publishing has really changed, you know, completely. And I don't want to...
Totally.
I don't want to waste my breath
itself
on that.
No,
because
no.
It's such negativity. But he said, "Show me if you've written any fiction." So I went home and I brought him The Man Who Murdered Poets, which was a Nabokovian pastiche about a young man who went off to murder the most famous poet of his age, thinking that by murdering him, he would supplant him. And I brought it to Aaron, and Aaron said, "This is a really good novel. Too much influence of Nabokov, of course. It's okay, it's good. Why are you impersonating a male poet?" And I said, "Well, because all the books that people take seriously have male narrators, or else mad housewife narrators who jump out windows," if you remember that period. And there were a lot of mad housewife novels in which the women, you know, went, I don't know if you know them, but they jumped out the window at the end because they had married the wrong man and they were afraid to break away and whatever. And I said, "But no novel in a woman's voice ever gets any decent reviews, ever is seen as literary." And he said, "Forget that. Go home and write a novel in the voice of those amazing poems. I'm going to put this on the shelf. You can walk down the street to Farrar Straus. You can go to Random House. Somebody will publish it. I won't." And I looked at him, and I said, "I won't, because if you write a novel in the voice of those poems, you will do something new. This is very good, but it's not new." And I made the decision to shelve that novel because he had put his finger on the problem. Mm-hmm. Totally put, which is very lucky to have had an editor like that. He was Saul Bellow's editor, and he was Philip Roth's editor, and he was very literary. So I wrote Fear of Flying, which I had been trying to write throughout my 20s. I had been saving string, so to speak. Probably it took me 10 years to get the voice of that book. And for me, unless I have the voice of the book, I don't have the book.
So how did you find the voice in this case?
Well, I'd been writing stuff for 10 years, ever since graduate school and college, but I didn't really know how it cohered at all. And then we went to a Congress, Alan Jung and I went to a Congress of Psychoanalysts in Vienna. And they had invited Anna Freud back after having expelled her family when the Nazi beastliness began. And she, of course, moved to Hampstead and started a child psychiatry clinic that became very famous. And they had invited her back to Vienna. By then, she was a very, very, very old lady. And the irony of Anna Freud coming back to Vienna when the Viennese had evicted her in the Nazi period, I don't know, it just sparked something. And I suddenly saw how I could begin the book.
Did you hear her talking in your head? I always hear them talking in my head.
Yes.
It's like a little voice that begins and won't leave me alone.
Exactly.
Do you know what I'm
exactly.
saying, Erica?
But we were there in Wien, a beautiful city, but a city that welcomed the Nazis, okay? So I think that in order to begin a novel, for me, you have to have a main character in a predicament. What was Isadora's predicament? She was married to a man she knew she couldn't stay with. It was a starter marriage. She knew that they had nothing in common. We call it today a starter marriage. Many of us have them. I had a few, okay? But what? I'm in my fourth marriage, and I've been in it for 26 years, a miracle. So, and I finally married somebody I adore and who adores me. But anyway, that doesn't matter. But in order to start a novel, there has to be a conflict. So Fear of Flying begins with Isadora in a conflict. She's at this place where the Nazis tried to murder all the Jews. They've invited Anna Freud back, who fled as a young woman.
Right.
And there's this irony. And then there are all these psychoanalysts who are trying to tell Isadora that if she would just accept her womanhood, she would be happy, which is what Freudians did in those days. Accept being a woman. And it was such a perfect thing. So Isadora finds this Langian shrink who's incredibly sexy, and he talks like a beetle. He's English. And her husband is so boring. He's a Freudian shrink. And although he's very protective of her, he doesn't get her at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. And whenever she shows him a cartoon in The New Yorker, he says, "Why do you think it's funny?"
He never answers anything. He only asks questions.
He only says, and when they go to a movie, I'll say, "Did you like the movie?" And he says, "What did you think of the movie?" Anyway, so she meets this man who seems to be totally free. And she runs off with him around Vienna, and they finally get in bed. And what happens? The old, what should we call it? The woman face to face with the limp dick. Right?
That says it.
The limp dick. Okay. So, nevertheless, she runs off with him because she's so bored. And that's the beginning of Fear of Flying, essentially. And then on this two-for-the-road kind of journey, which is a quest, she finds out what she must do with the rest of her life. An editor at that time told me there has never been a bestseller about a woman over 40.
He's wrong. There's about to be one.
It was a woman editor who was quite clever and, in fact, discovered me, Stephen King, and Ken Follett. She had beautiful taste. She died a few years ago of breast cancer, and she finally became one of my best friends. But she said this to me, and when I said, why are there no novels about older women? And she didn't know why. But I said, if they don't exist, we have to write them, which has always been what my novels are about. I want to fill the gaps that exist in the literature of women, in women's literature. So all this is only to say that until I have the voice and until I have the conflict, I have no book. And the reason Fear of Dying took me 10 years to write is because during that period, my daughter got sober at Hazelden. My husband nearly died of an aneurysm. My two parents died, and at the end of it all, I had to find my way as an older woman. So it's another quest novel, in a way, like Fear of Flying. I always thought Fear of Flying was basically a portrait of the artist as a young woman. And then it came out, and people thought it was The Happy Hooker. My first editor said, we'll never sell more than 3,000 copies. It's such a literary book about a woman who wants to be a poet. What did he know? And then my paperback editor, who was in the position of being head of a house because of feminism, she said, you're going to print 35,000 copies of that book in a hardcover, or I'm not going to pay you for the rights. And he said to her, this is Aaron, we'll eat the copies. It's such a literary book about a poet. And she said, it is not a literary book. It is the story of my life. And because there was a woman at the head of a house in 1970, there had not been before. The women were all underlings before that. She could say, this book is the story of my life. You're going to advertise it. You're going to print a certain number of copies, or I'm not buying the rights. And she proceeded to make it into a phenomenon. The 35,000 copies never sufficed. The book constantly went out of stock. It would climb the bestseller list, and then there would be no copies in the stores. And when the paperback came out in the fall of 74, it sold 3 million copies in the first 3 months. And then all the people who wouldn't have me on TV suddenly discovered they wanted me on TV. I remember a meeting in Johnny Carson's talent coordinator's office in New York. And she said to me, what is your book about? And I said, it's about a young woman who finds herself. And the talent coordinator said, Johnny isn't interested in human relationships. You don't forget lines like that. Then the book went on the bestseller list, and suddenly Johnny Carson was interested in human relationships. So it was a surprise to a lot of people. And it went on and on and on. It was published in German, in French. In French, it was a tough row to hoe because French publishers said, French women don't need psychiatrists, they have French men. And the German publisher said, we can't publish this because the heroine is talking about the Nazi past and we're not Nazis anymore. And they wanted me to write a foreword to the book in which I said, this is not the truth about Germany, this is just what a Jewish girl from New York thinks is the truth. And I said, I won't do it. I'm not going to apologize for my book. And my agent said, apologize for your book. Germany's a big market. And it went like that. It went like that. Last year, it was published in China, in non-pirated in Singapore, but a real edition published by a Chinese publisher, translated by a scholar, an American studies scholar at the University of Shanghai. And so the most amazing thing about this book is how it's gone into these other cultures. And people will come up to me in Hong Kong or Tokyo and say, "I am Isadora Wing." And I'm amazed, because I believe that if you tell the truth about feelings, our feelings are the same all over the world. We can be wearing a kimono, we can be wearing a burqa, we can be whatever. If you tell the truth about feelings, the feelings of people are the same. You can be back in the 18th century with Fanny Hackabout Jones, which is indeed my favorite novel. And the petticoats and panniers are different, but the feelings are the same. They can be riding in coaches, not in Teslas, but the feelings are the same. And so there you go. With Fear of Dying, I went against my old editor's rule that there can never be a bestseller about a woman over 40. She is in heaven right now. She died of breast cancer, sadly. She had become one of my closest friends. But she took that back later, because we talked about a lot of things. And Fear of Flying proved that it wasn't true. And this book will, I think, prove that it isn't true again. So that's pretty much how it came to be. Is there time to read a line or so, or
sure,
are we too late?
Sure, and then let me do an audience question.
Okay,
how's that?
Great. I'm just going to read you a teeny bit. I used to love the power I had over men. Walking down the street, my mandolin-shaped ass swaying and swinging to their backward eyes. How strange that I only completely knew this power when it was gone or transferred to my daughter. All male eyes on her nubile 20-ish body, promising babies. I missed this power. It seemed that the things that had come to replace it, marriage, maternity, the wisdom of the mature woman, ugh, I hate that phrase, weren't worth the candle. Ah, the candle, standing up, burning for me, full of sound and fury, signifying everything. I know I should fade away like a good old girl and spare my daughter the embarrassments of my passions. But I can't any more than I can conveniently die. Life is passion, but now that I know what passion costs, it's hard to be so carefree anymore. But was I ever carefree? Was anyone? Wasn't love always an exploding cigar? Didn't Gypsy Rose Lee say, "God is love, but get it in writing"? And didn't Fanny Bryce say, "Love is like a card trick. Once you know how it works, it's no fun anymore"? Those old broads knew a thing or two. And did they give up? Never. I'm not going to tell you yet how old I am or how many times I've been married. I have decided never to get older than 50. My husband and I read the obituaries together more often than we have sex. I am only going to say that when all the troubles of my family engulfed me, and I realized that I was just unhinged enough to put the following ad on Ziplist.com, a sex site on the internet. Happily married woman with extra erotic energy seeks happily married man. To share same. Come celebrate Eros one afternoon per week. Discretion is guaranteed by playful, pretty, imaginative, witty woman. Talk about a woman on the verge of a nervous breakdown. It was autumn in New York, season of mellow mists, Jewish holidays, and $5,000 a plate benefits for chic diseases, and so on. So she puts this ad on the internet, and the first thing she gets is a picture of a scanned Polaroid picture of an erect penis, a tawny, uncircumcised specimen with a drop of dew winking at the tip. under the photo, on the white border, was scrawled, "Without Viagra." The accompanying email was concise. "I like your style. Have always risen for assertive women. Send nude shot and measurements." The next one began like this. "Dear seeker, sometimes we think it's carnality we want when actually we long for Jesus. We discover that if we open our hearts and let him in, capital H, all sorts of satisfaction undreamt of can be ours. Perhaps you think you are seeking Eros, but Thanatos is what you really seek. In Jesus, there is eternal life. He is the lover who never disappoints, the friend who is loyal forever. It would be an honor to meet and counsel you." A telephone number was proffered, 1-800-JESUS-FOR-YOU. And that's pretty much where the book begins. And I won't tell you, but she does meet an assortment of lunatics, none of whom gives her even a stirring of lust. And that's where we begin the book.
That's perfect. No, we're not done.
We're not done.
Okay. We're not done.
Okay.
I have to ask you an audience question. It's required. Okay, so you were talking about finding the voice, and I have someone who's asked about what your writing process is. And I know for us writers that's kind of, well, it's not always the most intriguing question, but a lot of people want to know
how
you go about creating what you create. Do you keep a schedule? Do you do it every day? Do it on the fly? Do you shut yourself in the bathroom?
Right.
You know, what exactly do you do?
Well, what I've found is I don't have the book till I have the voice. And so I sort of save string. And I will write, basically, I will write all the little notes to myself. I remember writing Fear of Flying. I was living in Germany, and I remembered the German toilets, which at that time there were these little platforms where you could inspect your poop. And I had a theory about these toilets, that only the Germans would have toilets where you would inspect your poop. I would make little notes about things. Then I'd try a voice, and sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. And often with a novel, I do that. I did this with Fear of Dying. It took me 9 years. And I guess it took me 9 years because my parents were dying and my dog died and my daughter had 3 children and whatever. I mean, life intervenes. Once I get into it and I have the voice, then I go like the wind. And then they're always, and I never know what the arc of the story is until I'm into it about 100 pages. Around 100 pages into it, I sort of see the arc. I can't outline the book the way writers of thrillers can outline books. I discover the arc of the story. Around page 200, I see the arc glimmeringly. I start to see, oh, yes, it goes up here, and then there'll be the denouement here, but I'm not sure how the ending goes. And as I discover where the ending is going to be, I always somehow knew this book would end in India, but I had no idea what would happen. And it's a weird process. And on the downward slope towards the denouement, it goes like the wind. And sometimes I wake up at 3 a.m. and write. Often I wake up at 3 a.m. My husband says, "Oh my God, you must be finishing the book because you get up at 3, you get up at 4, you get up at 5. And I like to be in a quiet place, like our house in Connecticut, where I can get up in the morning and hear the birds singing. It works better. But once I'm into that, I can write anywhere. Once I start to see the downward slope. And then I write all the time. I don't write every day. Right now I'm promoting a book and I'm going from city to city to city and here in the United States, and then I'll go to Norway, and then I'll go to Italy, and then I'll go to London, and in the spring I'll probably go to Germany, and God knows when they finish the translations. But so you don't write all the time. But the important thing is, and I know this as a poet, when I get a line, like, I miss the power I have had, used to have over men, I write it down. And sometimes I don't know where that line leads. And sometimes I don't even know if it will stay the voice. But when I get that, like a poet, I know that somewhere along the line, it will lead me where I need to go.
You will use it.
What?
You will use it. It will take you where you need.
Sometimes you use it, sometimes you don't. But if you get a powerful line that gives you like a thrill in here, it's like a pointer in the woods, you know, for Red Riding Hood. And it says, go that way. And maybe you'll cut all of it. And maybe the working title of this book was Happily Married Woman. And maybe you won't even use it. And maybe it will take you somewhere, and it will lead you to the chapter, you know, that does begin the book. Most books would benefit by having the first two chapters cut.
Don't say that to me. I don't want to hear it.
But anyway, but I think, just like poetry, it's the voice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, darling.
This has been fabulous. I want to say there's something Vanessa's analyst says to her, mm-hmm. which is, turn your head around. And I think Erica always turns our head around. So thank you so much.
Oh,
this
Linda,
has been wonderful.
You.
I have one last thing I have to
okay.
say. The Commonwealth Club thanks Erica Jong, author of the legendary Fear of Flying, as well as her new novel, Fear of Dying. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series and is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. A reminder to everyone here that copies of Erica's and my book are on sale, and we'll be signing copies in the fireside room immediately following the program. I'm Linda Gray Sexton, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.